For great-looking t-shirts, hoodies, and sweatshirts, the TNT Shop is now open at tntradio.live. This is McBride and Brennan with David McBride and Dr. Robert Brennan on today's News Talk. TNT Radio.
Welcome to McBride and Brennan. I'm Major David McBride, military whistleblower, and I'm joined by my trusty sidekick and intellectual heavyweight, Dr. Robert Brennan. And we have a great show today. What I am trying to do is we're trying to get a bit more international. And we've got a very good international guest here, someone who strides a number of different worlds, born in the Ukraine, now lives in the United States, and studied in Moscow. He's a filmmaker and generally very, very interesting guy, Igor Lopotnik. I've didn't pronounce your name. But how are you, Igor?
Hi, David. Hi, David. Thank you. I'm good. And thank you for inviting me. Yes, my background was I was living in Ukraine 40 years. Was born in 1968. Moved to United States because of my film 2008. I did four films on Ukrainian crisis. Probably most well known. This is Ukraine on Fire, released in 2016 with Oliver Stone. And 2019, we did a sequel with him called, with title name, Revealing Ukraine. And after that, in 2021, the latest one was Ukraine, the Everlasting Present. And before that, in 2014, right on a hot footprints, we did one smaller film was called Maidan Massacre, about who was shooting the people on the streets of Kiev during the coup happening in February of 2014. So I'm Ukrainian American, American citizen, Ukrainian citizen and Russian citizen who's live and work in Los Angeles, California. And quite, you know, what's also interesting, I was grown up on the coast of Kakhovskaya Reservoir, what we call the sea, because it was so big, so big. And we was on the beach and swimming. I see that in the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant, four blocks across the coast on another side. So this was my childhood, what I spent on this Kakhovka. It's actually very big. It's the biggest, I believe, reservoir in Europe. So I think we can start with that topic.
Yeah. Tell us more about that. I love that. And it's great to have someone on who has inside information. You know, we'll never, I was thinking about it this morning, we're never going to be the majority, but it's nice to be the informed, powerful minority. And as long as we still have 20%, we're always going to have haters. But it's great to have, and it makes me laugh that you, one of your nationalities is Ukrainian. You were born in Ukraine.
Yes.
So the idea that you're a Russian asset is a bit ridiculous. Doesn't mean people wouldn't say it. But so tell us about the reservoir. Yeah, I want to pick your brains for all the inside information you have.
Yeah, the hydroelectric plant, what was built in Nova Kakhovka in the late 50s, was accomplished by the Soviet Union program of electrification of Ukraine. And also, that was a big the installation to manage the access to the water. They flooded a lot of territories and created a big, biggest reservoir. It's not quite big on a generating of electricity, but that provide a necessary level of water. And it also was from this area that was a channel was provide an entire water supply to Crimea, to all peninsula, because Crimea has no water resources. So what's happening lately? Kakhovka Dam was destroyed by Ukrainians. Why? It was happening during the nighttime. That was not a cause of engineering failure, because we have an evidence of seismic waves coming from this area. It was intentional act. And dam was destroyed. It started uncontrollably releasing a huge amount of waters. And now this is the highest level of water in a dam. So this flooding is happening. And immediately all trained Ukrainian propaganda, military propaganda, government propaganda, and all the Western advisors and helpers and amplifiers jump on that and start blaming Russia without any evidences. You know what? It's very funny how Ukrainians doing this and succeeding with that because they know how the information influence operation is working. First of all, why they blow the dam? We heard for like a 6 months about great and beautiful, big Ukrainian counteroffense, what's supposed to clear and liberate Ukrainian territories out of Russian occupation. And it's still not happening, it's not happening. But suddenly, on the night of June 4, it start happening. And Ukrainians, of course, was taking a huge casualties and achieving very little results. And they needed destruction. And that destruction was a dam. Why they did it and how we can expose them? This is very interesting. That's such a neoconservative, or I can say the neoliberal asset as a Washington Post can be used for that. Because an article from 29th of December 2022, in an interview of Ukrainian general whose name is Kovalchuk, that was a bragging about the Ukrainians tested HIMARS system and shelling the dam and targeting the floodgates to create artificial flood. And they succeed. And they was happy to announce that they targeted dam. And by the way, for 2022, that poor dam was targeted more than 10 times, shelling. And of course, as usual, they blame Russia. They blame Russia for that, what's actually cannot fit to my mind. They blame Russia for when they shelling Zaporozhye nuclear power plant. They blame Donetsk and Donbass people when they shelling Donbass for 8 years. And they said they doing it themselves. That was deliberate act of terror committed by Ukrainian government because they need a pause. They need the cover up for their counteroffense, and they need some kind of destruction to bring them more attention and to blame Russia in something. And they did it with a military reason as well, because that flood, what's happening now, not only preventing Russians from attack, and Ukrainians, by the way, from attack, but that give ability to Ukrainian military force to take forces from the area when the flood making this offense of Russian impossible, and to move that forces to the point when Ukrainian have active actions on a battlefield. So they achieve both goals, and after that they start using their usual information influence operation. And you know what's interesting? What they use it because there's no casualties, practically no casualties on the people, they start using animals. Because, of course, animals suffering, and they jump on this, and they generate a tremendous amount of fake news. Even, you know, the entire zoo in Novokakhovka was drowned. All animals killed. Doesn't matter, the entire zoo was relocated to Crimea in December 2022. You know what? It's working with people. It's even worked with my wife. She was crying when she reading this news because she is a dog lover, and as well as I am, we have a dog and a cat in the house. We love animals. Everybody loves animals. So this is a technique how to produce a cause what you need.
Yes,
so
it's very interesting. As part of the, you know, as also living in LA and part of the Hollywood the Hollywood set. If you look at the horror film genre, you can have a dozen teenagers killed by the serial killer, you know, just butchered, but the dog will always get out safe.
Yeah, it's a rule. Yeah, never kill the dog.
Yeah.
Never kill the dog. This is a rule. If you're killing the dog, oh my God, you're not all horror. You're disgusting. You cannot kill the dog.
Even the serial killer can't.
Of course. And the Ukrainians know that. And they was trained in this. That was the people in Langley and in Washington who explained them how to craft strategic communications, how to appeal to emotion. You know, we as a filmmakers, we did it all the time in the films. We build in the emotional connection first, and after that, we sell in our story. So what they did, exactly same technique, and you don't forget that the president of Ukraine is an actor. He has a lot of people around him who understand the technology and who teach him how to do that. And it's not Ukrainian people, not at all. This is the people from the United States. And they teach him, you need to do this and that. And they was preparing for this. And now they're running a big campaign. Everybody, actors on this, George Soros asset, Greta Thunberg, blaming Russia for unprovoked invasion. What in the world Greta know about provoking an invasion for the 8 years of shelling Donbas, for the everything, for violating all red lines what Russia installed to prevent the direct conflict? She know nothing, but she blame Ukraine for artificial disaster, ecological disaster, and have no clue about who did it and how. Anyway, but to understand what's going on in Ukraine overall, we need to go back to my film, what was I mentioned before, called Ukraine on Fire, and to study that roots of this conflict, study how Ukraine convert from the independent state to state, to failed state, what's interesting only in one goal, to run in war economy and to be a puppet who poking the Russian bear and to try and to provoke Russians and their uncontrolled and emotional motions. What's actually they never achieved from the beginning of this, the war, or Russians call it special military operation. Russians never caused the civilian casualties intentionally in Ukraine. Yes, of course, it's a war and people dying, but they never bombed that places when people live in. Everything, casualties in civilian, a lot of casualties in civilian was caused by air defense working, because Ukrainians do not hesitate to place air defense units inside of city and fire the rockets right from the streets and a backyard. They did it before, they don't care about, and they using the collateral friendly fire damages as a tool in informational war and in propaganda war against Russia. But how this all started, we need to go back to 2014, when the bloody coup happened in Kiev, and the regime was based their ideology on a radical ultra-nationalist ideas of Stepan Bandera and other Ukrainians collaborators with the Nazi during the World War II, was set up as a basement for entire Ukrainian independence to make Ukraine different than Russia. They was working on the destroying the Russian language in Ukraine, because Ukrainians speak Russian in their everyday life. They very, very rare when Ukrainians speak Ukrainian language. That language is more popular in the Western area, what's the minority in Ukraine. But in the Eastern and industrialized areas of Ukraine, and in Kiev themselves, people speak in Russian language. So they stopped teaching Russian language in the schools first, from the time of independence, smaller and smaller, less and less. I experienced the problem when I moved from Dnipropetrovsk to Kiev, from eastern part of Ukraine to the heart of Ukraine, to the capital, to find a good school for my kids. And finally, I managed to do that. It was only 4 schools and a huge 3 million population city left. So they started attacking their language first. After that, they start setting up the identity of Ukrainian people as a different, than identity of Russians. But Ukrainians was living together with Russia for 300 years plus, because during the Bogdan Khmelnytsky in the 17th century, when Ukrainian Cossacks from Zaporozhye decided to unite with Russia and signed an agreement in the Pereyaslav Rada, after that, Russia, Russian Empire, and after Russian Empire, Soviet Union was investing heavily in Ukraine resources, and that was a friendly, very friendly relationship, and people was benefiting from the common language, from a common culture, and a common religion, because both Russian and Ukrainian, they believe in Orthodox Church, and Ukrainian Orthodox Church, it's a similar to Russian Orthodox Church, it's completely safe. So when 2014 coup happened, and the people in Ukrainian opposition, they decided to invite such a forces what they cannot control, like as American neoconservative Victoria Nuland and all gang behind her with George Soros and Joe Biden and all Senator McCain, all, like all scum in the world was invited just to overthrow government what was democratically elected President Yanukovych. And as soon as I saw that, I can't hold myself. I understand I need to make a film, and I got a hand from Oliver Stone, my dear friend now and a partner for 4 films what we did together. I was also helping him with Snowden Fisher film, and we did the free documentary together when he was a producer and I was director, and I also helped him with his project. So we collaborate. I see him a few days ago on the release of his latest film, Nuclear Now, about nuclear energy. So we did Ukraine on Fire, we released it. Of course, I was immediately stamped blend as a Russian asset, a Kremlin agent, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't care. I care because I believe that people of the world need to have alternative vision from a mainstream media narrative, what's happening in Ukraine for real, what cause of that actions and why. Because you know what, why it's important for everyone now in the world? Because that war, if not controlled, can grow to something unimaginable and cause all of us just to extinct in a World War III. This is what I try to avoid with my films. This is why all our films were ending up with a clear message. Be careful with the fire, because when you're playing with the fire and you're not controlling fire, fire not only can burn you, fire can burn you to death. And this is exactly the, our goals was to prevent any military conflicts in Ukraine. Unfortunately, we not succeed with that goal, but we did everything and we keep going. We keep pushing on this.
It's great to hear your story. It's really, it's inspiring for me. And there's a lot of things that I recognize. It's almost, in fact, I think they probably do have a handbook in Washington, D.C. and the information operations, probably all these things they learnt by mistake in Vietnam, things they got wrong in the Vietnam War, they've spent the last 50 years perfecting, and that's getting the media on side. I've never seen such a one-way coverage of any war that I've seen in Ukraine or any military action where there is no dissent at all. And you're right about the false flag attacks. I was laughing about it with journalist Richard Medhurst this morning, saying that they could do the most ridiculous thing. They could bomb the Kremlin and say the Russians did it themselves. Russian dissidents must have done it, you know, and they would get away with it. You know, the New York Times and they would. It's become so ridiculous now. Everything is actually the Russians, no matter how ridiculous it is, that the Russians bombed their own pipeline. The tragedy is that they're getting away with it, and it's great to have people like you who are not afraid to speak up despite all the hate that you get, it's very, you know, people like you are going to save the world, because I agree, a nuclear war is possible, and a nuclear war which could have been avoided is just the most horrific kind of thing. And I laugh when you talk about the animals in the zoo drowning, because that's the sort of thing.
Oh, yeah.
Part of my job in the military was approving psyops and information operations, approving the false information and trying to decide. And yes, I can recognize false information when I see it now. And they did similar things in Syria, where they had clearly fake pictures of gay people being killed by ISIS. Not that that didn't happen, but you could tell by these the way that these pictures were framed or whatever, that they weren't real, in order to get the progressives to get, who normally might oppose war, thinking, oh yeah, I'm going to support this war because, you know, it's a woke war. And I could see, I also saw that in Ukraine, actually. I saw this very beautiful woman supposedly singing a lullaby to her child, asking for a no-fly zone. But I think you have a feeling she was a model in Los Angeles. And, but people fall for that emotional kind of stuff.
They do.
Correct.
Meanwhile, fun fact, no relation, but CIA Director John Brennan and Victoria Nuland, who's Secretary of State, or the Assistant Secretary of State, were both in Kiev at the time of this plucky coup by the emergent but yet extremely well organized by the Ukrainian people.
And funded. And yes. Funded by, you know, the president of Yanukovych, he tell me the story when during Maidan, that's an entire plane filled with a cash in the bills of 20 bucks, small bills, was landed in Kiev. They transferred it to United States Embassy, 20 million in cash, just to help people on a square of independence in a Maidan, when Maidan was happening, just to stay warm and be fitted. So this was a bloody orchestration in this coup, that coup dragged for the months. And the Ukrainian president at this time, Viktor Yanukovych, you can see himself speaking about that, was targeted to death. They tried to kill him. They organized the attempt there when his motorcade was driving without him from Kiev to Kharkov. And that was two snipers, and it was a mercenaries. That was not Ukrainian special forces. That was not an appraisers. That was a professionals who on the intersection shooting them. And I was introduced to his security detail person, and he showed me the wound, what was happening. And that if you project in this, it's a different height of his and president. President is a tall guy, so it will be ended up exactly in his heart if it will be president sitting in this place. So they do not hesitate to augment the color revolution technology, make it more violent, make it more brutal, because they want a war. They want war with Russia, and they still, and danger is here, danger, because they're planning the propaganda operation, they're planning the informational influence operation here in Washington. They spitting this out of Ukrainian mouth of comedian actor and all his surrounding, what's actually the gang and the junta. And after that, our media take this out and chew it and believe, and people believe, and they start believing in their own constructed reality, would have nothing to do with reality on the ground. And they start believing in their own propaganda. And this is a danger here, because you start living not in a real world, you start living in a construct. And you
That's
believe
exactly what happened
that Putin,
in Afghanistan. We started to believe our propaganda and start fighting an enemy that wasn't there. Very funny.
You know, David, I study now for my next film about different country, But very interesting subject. What I find in reading the book about coup in Iran in 1953, what was completely done by CIA and installing the Shah as a ruler, was all the time, every time when United States meddling in foreign affairs and changing governments abroad, that fighting back and causing a huge damage to United States policy, as it happened with Iran. Because Iran is a great sample, but we have something in development, Ukraine. We see that in Guatemala and in other 70 countries abroad of United States, when all attempts to keep war abroad and to change the government and put the, in charge the boys what's playing the ball as we want, actually, sooner or later, falling.
Backfires. Mm-hmm. You know, I had that discussion with Richard Meadows this morning. 9/11, all of these things can be traced directly back to American aggression policy, short arming of terrorists overseas. Yeah, they. I totally agree with you. Let's make a film together. I love all of that.
Oh, I'm in now. I've said it a million times, this never applied more than this time. We definitely need a big fat part two with Igor.
Yeah, we do. We want to have you back, Igor. Our best beginning so far.
But we'll have to go to an ad break too right now.
Yeah.
All right. Catch us later. This is TNT.
TNT Radio's Charlie Robinson.
$880 billion was the number I saw. Now, San Francisco can't make their rent, okay? They're bankrupt. The entire city is bankrupt. But yeah, let's carve out almost $1 trillion to pay people that weren't slaves money in a state that didn't have slaves from a bunch of people that, I don't know, never really even owned slaves either. So it seems like a really dumb idea. North Carolina, though, where you guys are, that was actually a slave area. Where are your reparations?
There's no speak of reparations right here. Now, of course, I don't want them. All right. I do not want them.
I know you don't.
Look, yeah. The simple fact of reparations is ridiculous because the people who may have needed them have been long gone. I mean, they haven't been on this planet for a while now. So it makes no sense at all, reparations at this point in time. And then plus, with the way our currency is currently, as far as devaluing the dollar, I mean, yeah, just go ahead and drop $800 billion, you know, into the marketplace with no product behind it, and I'm pretty sure nothing will skyrocket in price. Right, Charlie? Nothing to go
right,
up.
Yeah.
Charlie Robinson on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
A better business tip from TNT Radio. The benefits of advertising on today's News Talk, TNT Radio, should be clear to businesses of any shape or size. It can be accessed anywhere, anytime, by anybody, and is the perfect way to build brand awareness and stimulate digital activity. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
You're listening to McBride and Brennan with David McBride and Dr. Robert Brennan on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Yes, this is TNT, and our very, very special guest and the man of the second half hour is Lieutenant Colonel Sajez Sangari. Now, he has a hell of a bio, but let's try and sort of get through it, even if we couldn't live up to it in the real world. U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel retired, Sajez Sangari, is the CEO of the Near East Center for Strategic Engagement and the host of the program New Paradigms Show. He was born and raised in Iran. While serving in the U.S. Army, Sajez had 6 years of continuous combat deployment in the Mideast, conducted 144 combat patrols, 22 special forces missions, and survived seven IED attacks. During this time in the Army, he held a diplomatic post as U.S. Director of Host Nations Affairs in Kuwait, and he has a deep skill set in the Middle East languages and cultures and understands the plight of the Syrian and other Christians in the Middle East, and now uses his 20-year-plus military experience to help Christians in their struggle against ISIS. And it's a great pleasure to have you with us.
It's good to be here, guys.
Yes, so... So where shall we begin? Because you've had a lot of interest lately in the developments in Sudan, and I was just reflecting because our previous guest was talking about Kiev and Ukraine, and it's like the whole world is into Ukraine at the moment. But does the world know about Sudan and Yemen and Myanmar, otherwise known as Burma, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? There's flashpoints everywhere.
They are everywhere. Sudan, the reason we got involved in it is because once the United States pulled out of Afghanistan, we knew that these are key footprints, right? If you're going to counter, especially what the U.S. is trying to do globally against whether it be Russia or China. And from the U.S. perspective, the day once we left our equipment back there, I remember the next day I was flying to D.C. to brief as to what the ramifications would be. And then we knew that the next flashpoints would be in Africa, because if you kind of look at what the previous administrations had done, especially under the Obama administration, if you go back to a speech that was given by Wang Yi at the time at the Brookings Institute in 2012, he named his speech New Power Relations. And in that speech, he kind of gave a vision of what he thought China and the U.S. need to have as far as a vision to work together so they would not be heading towards a war in the future. So when Susan Rice took to the stage right after Wang Yi had given his speech, from the U.S. perspective, most of us thought that we were going to counter what Wang Yi's vision was. Unfortunately, from the U.S. side of the house, Susan Rice tried to see how we can maybe actualize that particular vision. And now fast forward to where we have the current administration under the Biden administration, the same kind of characters who kind of were working through that process or where we are today. So what you see in Ukraine is kind of the same chess pieces being set as to what was initially discussed in 2012, and U.S. and China still jockeying for position globally, which has allowed what is happening currently with the competition that's happening in Africa, with Sudan and South Sudan are important because they're the key footprint into African resources itself, include the Republic of Congo, and what is happening in Europe, which is a major war taking place where you're going to have competition to whether or not Russia, as part of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization led by China, is going to be a strong and viable capability to what is happening with the U.S. footprint in the future. And as you can see, even with the Turkish elections and where NATO is currently under really pressures by Erdogan and his new administration as to whether or not U.S. will be able to counter the possibility of a Shanghai Cooperation Organization with its NATO allies in the future.
Mm. And it's fascinating because you were born and raised in Iran, and there's a sort of a theme that goes across both Turkish politics, Ukrainian politics, even to an extent in so much as Sudan stares across the Red Sea at Saudi Arabia, even its politics, that it's this natural orientation that countries have towards the East, as the Middle East or the Near East, as part of the East. You know, like the Maidan coup, well, it refers to Independent Square in Kiev, and Maidan is a Persian word. And yes, so, yes, it's not from the French, it's not from the German, it's a Persian word. So it speaks to, you know, Ukrainians' place geographically, culturally, historically. And of all people, our next guest, you were a Farsi speaker, I imagine.
Yeah, look, here's what's happened. Really, if you look at 100 years ago, it was a Sykes-Picot agreement between the French and the British that really kind of set the foundation of what the Middle East was going to look like. Every time Middle East is in peace, you have peace globally. Every time Middle East is in turmoil, you have turmoil. Now, the United States and Russia were those two competing pieces. Just going back to when the Sykes-Picot Agreement expired and going back almost 15 prior to that expiration was when we're looking at where the Russia and U.S. were going to be. Unfortunately, what happened is with the rise of China, now you have a third major power in this process of an equation. And what happens is it completely offsets the kind of a balance of two powers globally. And look, China is not going to be on the U.S. side. period, it's more likely that we knew that China and Russia were going to be together, especially of the fact that you had established the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which China is in the lead of, which was initially established to counter NATO's ability to be able to project its treaties and economic agreements as they were being set globally. So it's put the U.S. in a position where even General Boykin recently said, you know, U.S. looks like a declining power. And that's not to say that you cannot counter, but now you're countering against two major powers. You're always going to be kind of looking down on the hill, you know, looking up as these two major powers are trying to secure the top of the hill. You know, I was in Australia just 4 years ago now, 5 years ago, and I gave a a white paper to the shadow minister there as to what is happening regionally in Asia, and everything that is now you see on this kind of a geopolitical chess pieces are being moved. Really started going back to when China came in and now kind of offset the so-called two, you know, worlds of Russia and U.S. being those competitors. Now, we believe that what would happen is, especially like in Africa, as we go back there, that, and you mentioned Burma too, that there would be a possible competition that would take place between these major powers, especially for the resources in Africa, as maybe U.S. withdraw from the Middle East and focus more internally or even on South America. But however, you know, we would consider from the U.S. perspective, France as being a competitor, but we'd look at China as more of an adversary from the U.S. perspective, because as I wrote a white paper when I looked at the Burma genocide, and that was taking place in a year to the date that I submitted that white paper to the National Security Council, was when the General Halang conducted the coup in Burma. And we saw that it was a Chinese conglomerates that were tied to General Halang's operations. In the particular case there, you had the Rohingyas being pushed out because of the fact that you had CITIC, which is China International Trust Investment Corporation, was rolling a $14 billion project into that region and needed that region cleared to do those type of operations to build that deep water port, so it could take oil transports and processing facilities and other projects that were either coming in or going out directly being, you know, pipeline to the Middle East, which was also at the same time a fight to try to control the Straits of Malacca. So these things happen globally between competitors, unfortunately, in the process. You know, we have major wars that take place because of it.
And what's happening with Sudan that you want to put us in the picture of?
Well, Sudan was really kind of a counter to what the Abraham Accords were. The Abraham Accords really kind of reset everything under the previous POTUS here, President Trump, President of the United States. That's what POTUS stands for on the U.S. side. And it was really when we saw that the U.S. was interested in pulling out of the Middle East and kind of focusing internal, under the Obama administration, the want was to leave, but focus on South America. Trump wanted to leave Middle East, but he wanted to pivot against China. And we kind of saw maybe a new shift in the Near East map, where you would have Israel as kind of a lead to a new Near East map, with India possibly being part of that. And then the Abraham Accords allowed that strengthening of that capability to possibly counter, again, we go back to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is led by China. Unfortunately, these fights did take place, and Sudan had just recently been that kind of a stabilizing block in Africa for Israel. And now you have a complete war that is taking place in Sudan. South Sudan is pretty much controlled by the Chinese Communist Party. And as I had mentioned to my Israeli intel buddies, with the resources that sit in the former Republic of Congo, you could buy the state of Israel. So that is really kind of all tied to this maturation of trying to get a footprint and to control, to get into those resources. So it's the U.S. trying to maybe counter China, China trying to block from U.S. being able to have access. But in the process, what happens is nations fight over these type of resources. Unfortunately, they lead to these type of smaller wars. When you have three major figures in this case, where they found two worlds of, in this case, global powers like Russia and the United States, now having a third in the mix, what happens, at least to these smaller powers now, that you see kind of emphasizing their ability to want to be able to have more of a say on the international stage, the Iranians introducing new possible hypersonic missiles, being involved in drone operations against Kyiv. You have Turkey recently with the new elections where Erdogan can keep NATO hostage if it wants to, depending if you know, Sweden decides to give up the Kurdish operators, as Turkey calls them, for them to prosecute with what is happening with the internal attacks into Turkey, for them to allow NATO to be able to allow a new member. And so these smaller nations are going to now start kind of having more of a smaller geographic fights. They won't be as big possibly, but they will be very bloody. And Sudan is an example of what you see other places throughout Asia and the Middle East.
Mm. I think I saw somewhere that didn't Victoria Nuland, who I've just talked about, go to visit Sudan? That could be a sign of, I've been to Sudan and the northern part rather than the southern part, and I am back in around the year 2000, and I have to admit I quite enjoyed it. We went up the Nile, and it was relatively peaceful then, and quite an interesting sort of state. But I guess that at least that they're flexing their options. I wish we did that in Australia a bit more. I wish we were able to sort of stay open-minded, and you get the great powers competing, whereas we're kind of owned by the US, and we don't as a result we get pulled one way or the other. I'm fascinated by your Persian background. I've been to Iran as well, and I think that is that's fantastic that you served in the U.S. You're a bit like me. You're a patriot. You served in the army a long time, did a lot of things, and a language specialist as well. So you've got a fantastically interesting background, and I'm glad it's good to have people like you who are obviously truth tellers and upstanding, actually keeping everybody honest.
Gentlemen, we'll have to go to a quick ad break. This is TNT.
De-weaponizing weather with reality and perspective.
I'm in Newark, New Jersey right now. I'm here to watch a wrestling tournament tomorrow. And the reason I'm telling you that is twofold. One, when I was a kid, people used to say, and I didn't agree with this, that Newark was the armpit of the world. I don't agree with that for a second. And of course, one of the things we have to remember is the armpit is an essential body part. But the reason I'm bringing this up is, Scott, I didn't look too bad around here. Visibility's around 10 miles. Looks like the smoke is gone. I wonder if the climate change somehow has gotten rid of all the smoke. Of course, I am being facetious. Maybe one of you can write TNT and give me a definition of that word. It has more than two syllables, and everybody knows that I'm a Neanderthal because of my climate change position. But the fact is, the smoke is clearing out of the northeast part of the United States. And much of the United States is cooler than normal. It's going to get mighty, mighty hot in Texas. I know that comes as a shock to you, that it's going to get hot in Texas during summer. And guess what? There's going to be severe weather this weekend in the southern part of the United States. So you see, that's the glory of the climate change situation. You can get rid of the wildfire smoke, but all we got to do is run to Texas and severe weather, and we can blame climate change again. This is TNT Climate and Weather Watchdog Meteorologist Joe Bastardi, asking you to enjoy the weather. It's the only weather you got.
Imagine.
$11, thanks.
People driving through your workplace. Oi! Oh dear.
Oi! That was a
fresh pot.
Well, that's what road workers live with every day.
Jeez.
So don't make it dangerous by driving carelessly through roadworks. Look up, slow down, take care.
Where are my chips?
That was a fresh pint.
Because you wouldn't like it. Authorised by the State Government, Perth.
You're with David McBride and Dr. Robert Brennan on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to McBride and Brennan. I'm military whistleblower David McBride. I'm joined by Dr. Robert Brennan, and we have a very special guest in our international series, former U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Sargis Sangari, who was born in Iran and grew up in Iran, and was then a combat soldier in the U.S. Army, and is now has kind of done too much for us to talk about in a very short space of time. I want to talk to you about your work with Christians before we go, because and Christian minorities in the Middle East, and tell us a bit about the work you've done there.
No, part of what we did was when I retired in 2014 from the U.S. military, I established the Near East Center for Strategic Engagement on September 11 in the honor of the 3,000-plus Americans that were murdered on our soil here. And also the first responders are still dying from the complications that arose from the fires and the smoke that they had to deal with. So the first mission we picked up was the advisory group for the Assyrian Christian Army. I know that there's almost 100,000 Assyrian Christians that are live in Australia itself. And part of that mission was we basically conducted tier one, tier two level operations, which would be your special unit operations in both Iraq and Syria against ISIS. So a lot of the Christians just basically were, you know, displaced throughout the entire region. And when the commander of the forces came to me initially, and this is what is important in the microcosm of the issues, I laid out a couple of photos in front of him. One was an old photo of a Kurdish captive under the Ottoman Empire. And I said, "Do you know who this guy is?" He said, "I have no clue." I said, "This gentleman is an individual who's linked to the family members that are linked to the weapons of mass destruction that are coming out of Libya into the Middle East and Syria." And then I asked him, "Do you know what happened in 2014, in October, with Japan?" He said, "I don't know." I said, "Well, Japan bought a lot of the U.S. debt, which is why it's very complicated for us whether or not we can counter in Syria or not." And he said, "What does this have to do with me fighting in northern Iraq?" I said, "If you don't know how these things are linked, you're not going to be able to help even a village in northern Iraq." So we were able to conduct operations on the ground. We funded it through United Assyrian Appeal, which is a 501c3 project that we have here. I basically gave money to multi families and then their loved ones and went and fought. And they did a wonderful job. One day, the story will be told, the book will be written, and maybe even, as State Department wanted years ago, to do a movie. Now we're going to be hitting our, in 2024, basically, you're looking at 10 years from when initially we started these operations. We pulled that multi-force structure off the battlefield once the Kurds and the Arabs started kind of bashing each other once operations were done against ISIS. But Operation Collective Action is what we signed and handed over to the Office of the Secretary of Defense with the commander's approval for operations to clear Mosul. From there also we focus on the South Sudanese Christians to help them out, because my company does focus on Near East and adjacent countries. And South Sudan, of course, being a strategic location from the U.S. perspective, but at the same time, there's hundreds of thousands of refugees in Kenyan refugee camps because of what has happened within Sudan. So we try to support the Etana Woman Organization up in the north of Iraq, and we also work with the Jacaranda Woman Organization in Kenya to help the refugees that are dealing with these type of genocide issues, especially throughout the Middle East.
It's fantastic. You've got a fantastic story, and I've been around a bit myself, but I'm fascinated hearing some of those special missions that you've been involved with. It's you've helped a lot of people stay alive and a lot of people fight for their dreams in places that it sounds like almost like a storybook, but that's one of the great things, I guess, about being a specialist in having come from a different background. And it's great that the U.S. Army took you, because you are a real asset to them. If you can, I'd like to be like that myself, but a peacemaker, and to go to places where they're different to you, but to able to enable them to fight for their freedom, their liberty, and their beliefs. It's that the very best of those small teams. I saw them in Afghanistan. ODAs, I think they were called, and they were small teams in villages.
Yeah, Operation Detachment Alpha teams. And I actually had my own team when I was in Alambar the first time, advising on three ODAs in that region. But look, David, as you know, you give the information out there, sometimes they don't know how to handle it or deal with it or how to process it through the bureaucracies. And a lot of times, sometimes it falls on deaf ears, or people just don't know how to actually process it to be able to have any effects. So, you know, all you could do is brief the decision makers. You know, they may turn your hair white. I lost pretty much most of my hair trying to, get the bureaucrats to understand what the significance are. But we do what we can with what we have. And, we've at least saved some lives in the process if you have an effective, really, the long-term
outcome. Yeah, no, well, that's enough. That's enough. They say that in the Talmud, I think, on one of those books, that to see you save one life, you save the world. And it's beautiful to hear you say that. I've got hair, but it's totally white. And it went white overnight because of stress, of fighting my own organization. So I hear you there. I don't know how much hair you've got left, Robert Brennan, for fighting your own organization.
I just comb it over the fringe and pretend.
That's the cost of being a true believer, I think, is having bad hair.
I'm not losing hair. It's just that my forehead's getting bigger.
That's right. It's a stylistic choice. Yeah. Very, very good. And we need to do some more research, I think, to ask you some really pointed questions. But the sort of stuff that you've seen, Colonel, is highly specialist. But yeah, and I love those small operational detachments. I saw one in one of the Shiite areas of Afghanistan, and there was only four of them, and four American sort of special rangers, I guess they were, in this ODA, and they controlled pretty much the whole province, because with skill and with diplomacy and a little bit of chutzpah, I guess, they were able to do a lot more than 10 or 20 times the amount of soldiers. It is a really good system. I think it's one of the best things that the U.S. Army do, having small units there. And as you said, you can sometimes only really affect the small area, but that is something. And then those people will remember your small team and the good that you did. And that in itself means that flame is carried on. It's very powerful. And I'd like to thank you for the work that you've done in keeping the faith, which is not always easy, fighting bureaucracy. And thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been terrific. And I'm going to go away and think about all the things you've done. It's been...
No, David, much appreciated for having me here. And I hope what I discussed does help you and your audience. And anytime you guys need me, don't hesitate. Much appreciated.
Well, it's a hell of a bio. I mean, far out. You survived 7 IED attacks and, 22 special forces missions, 144 combat patrols. Yeah.
No, it's impressive. Thank you for your service, as they say. It's a great story, and growing up in Iran as well, and then getting to the States. It's I'm loving it, and then getting all these rather specialized missions, like helping the Christians, who are surrounded behind enemy lines and are getting attacked.
And we're going to have to do a deeper dive next time when we get you on about Turkey, because Erdogan has just survived an election by the skin of his teeth. Yeah. Anyway, this is TNT. McBride and Brennan.
Another great show.
Very pleased to have had you.
Thank you very much, Colonel.